erratics, notable trees, you know, different things like that, vernal pools, you know. So those that interest is a big factor. Safety is another one. When I created this trail, I was very mindful of the fact that there's hunting that goes on around the park, and I didn't want people wandering off accidentally into or being very close to where people would be hunting. So I tried to pull the boundaries of the perimeter inward a little bit, so to create a little bit of a buffer there for that safety thing. Another safety thing just had to do with people getting lost. There our property abuts Naugatuck State Forest, and they have some trails there, and there had never really been a good set of maps that showed where they intersected, where you left one and entered the other. It was often a source of confusion when you got back there. So making sure that the trails intersected with the other trails in a orderly and logical way, and then ultimately when we created things, that they were very clearly marked as to what was going on. So safety in those two respects was really important. Thirdly, had to do with maintenance. I had been involved with Connecticut or National Trail Day, and we would often go up there and be working to maintain the trails. And it's one thing to go out and clear brush that's fallen down. I mean, that's going to happen. It's a forest. But when trails are created that go through, a third safety feature too is just the kind of terrain that you're going over. You know, you want to be careful about, you know, steep areas. You want to be careful about areas that have a lot of very rocky areas that people can twist their ankles as they're walking. You want to try to avoid these boulder fields, if you will. And also when you're crossing streams and things like that, you want to be careful about, people slipping and falling and that kind of stuff. So that's a sort of a third safety issue. The maintenance thing is also, I think you could sort of say, the maintenance thing is, so there we have the Red Trail, for example, is also sort of a fire road that gets from down below all the way back into Naugatuck State Forest. So there was nothing really I could do with that trail. I mean, I couldn't, abandon it as I did some segments or move it around, because it had to be workable for a truck or something to be able to get back there. Maybe not a big fire truck, but something, that could actually drive back there. So that was a place in particular that almost every year we had to go back in and put water bars in or replace water bars because things were all washing out and that kind of stuff. And the road was becoming difficult to drive on because you were getting a lot of exposed rock and things like that in odd places to try and bang over with your car or your truck or whatever. So I wanted to create trails that did not really require maintenance in and of themselves. That the sheer walking of a trail would beat down a path that would keep it open without having to be going back and shoring up these things. So there were sections of trail, of existing trail, that I totally abandoned and rerouted to avoid having those things. And another flip side of that is that particularly those kinds of things, you don't want to have, and this is more sort of from an environmental standpoint, you don't want to be creating trails that go straight up and down hills, even if they're not all that long, because it just becomes a path for the water and it just erodes away. And that's not a good feature at all. So to try to conserve soil and things like that and that kind of stuff, you want to do that. Also from sort of a natural standpoint, you want to avoid sensitive areas. So that there are certain places that, you know, it might be interesting to sort of see, but maybe it's better to see them from a distance or not have the trail go straight through them. So you don't have a laurel grove and chop your way through a laurel grove. You know, I mean, if there's an existing path that you can take, fine, that's great. If you want to go past it, that's great. But you don't want to be damaging gratuitously, you know, sensitive areas, either from the making of the trail or from, you know, having people be too proximate to it. So, for example, there's a vernal pool up there, and vernal pools are very fragile environments. I mean, this is a place where there, you know, certain endangered salamanders and things like that are, and this kind of stuff. And if everybody's up there just stomping through and things like that, or grabbing things in an unsupervised way, that's not a very great situation. So, there's also this, for example, another example, there's this enormous, I mean, like cabin size glacial erratic that is on the new property that we just got. And it has this, it literally cleft right in half. And you can walk, if you do get down there, you actually can just about walk right through this thing. And it's really pretty cool. But it's the one side in particular is just lined with this really thick, beautiful moss and everything like that. And on the top, there's this whole little ecosystem of things trying to grow on the top. And if you took your trail through that cut, which a lot of people would have done, that moss would all be ripped off of there as people are going through and trying to crawl up. And the place
exactly.
would be destroyed. You know, yeah. So the trail that I created follows the line, the edge of a hillside that looks down on this, but doesn't take you there. You know, now people are going to find it anyway. They're going to see it. I mean, you know, they're not going to be able to keep everybody away. But the vast majority of people who come through there are going to follow the trail and look at it, and that's it. They're not going to go ahead and create the havoc that routing the trail through there would cause. Same thing with wetlands, you know. And stream crossings. You want to be careful about that and come up with things. And so those things too go back. I mean, partly I mentioned it as a safety thing, but also it's just a matter of ease of hiking. You know, you want to, if you have a hillside, you want to kind of either avoid the hillside if you can, but obviously sometimes that's not a thing. You want to switch back getting up there and do it in a sensible way. You want to avoid boulder fields, as I said, just because it's hard to walk. You want to avoid wetlands because they're wet, you know, and one, it's not good to be tramping through it, but two, it's a mess to, you know, who wants to walk through, you know, mud and water and stuff like that, and flooded areas. So you want to try and find, so you'll see a stream coming down, and very often, you know, it'll get wider and narrower and wider, you know, depending on terrain and the width of the little valley that it's going through. And so you try and make your trail cross at sort of a choke point on the stream where you can come down without having to go through a lot of either boulders or wetlands and find a place where you can cross, and then you ride up the other side and get through that. So that, you know, it takes time often to try and navigate how, because it isn't just a matter of finding it. You also have to figure, okay, this is the place I want to cross, but I'm way over here. Now, how do you actually get there? Is there a sensible way? And you may not actually, that may actually be the best place to cross, but getting from here to there may involve going through other things that you don't want to go through. And so you have to kind of pick a secondary place. But I mean, that's one of your major thoughts, is how do you easily get across there? Also, the inland wetlands people do not like you mucking around with anything having to do with the wetlands. Mm-hmm. So they don't want you building all sorts of dams or putting a whole bunch of rocks in and creating a whole bunch of stepping stones, because that dams things up. You know, so all of those kinds of things are probably, because the one place on the Red Trail, somebody had gone ahead and done that. And what had been maybe 8-10 feet area of water to get across now is about 20-25 feet across, because every time they put things in, the water backed up and then ran around the sides, and then they had to extend it, and then it ran around the sides, and it's this big long mess. And it's I mean, we are trying, because it's the Red Trail and has to be a road, I've left it as a road, but the actual walking path we've now diverted to cross that stream further up at a different place without having to have that kind of issue. A lot of times, you know, when you're doing these trails, you often try and work with existing like forest roads and things like that. And because they're already out there and you don't have to do a lot more clearing and they're already, you know, depending on how overgrown they are. I mean, they may be actually be pretty wide open. But a lot of times when the farmers were doing these things, they did not really care about what they did when they crossed the stream. And so oftentimes you may use a forest road for a little ways, but when it gets to cross a stream, you may reroute and try and cross at a different place, because the legacy of their crossing all that time has made that a very messy area now. Has often really broadened the area that you have to cross. It becomes more of a ford sometimes than a little stepping stones across. And it's important to go back when you're doing these things and see the trails in different seasons, because if you go through in the winter, and, you know, everything is very, you know, all the leaves are down, so things look a lot clearer than they are when summer comes around, and you often get in there and realize there is more brush, there's more stuff on the ground that you didn't really pay attention to because it didn't leaf out, and the original place that you picked was not such a great idea. Or you go through in the summer or something, and everything looks dry, and then you go there in the spring, and
it's a swamp.
You realize that's where all the runoff is coming from the hillside, and it's not just staying in a nice little channel. It actually is over quite a big area. So sometimes it's really tough getting through some areas because the runoff area, it's not a wetland per se, but it is because there's no real standing water ever, but the drainage field is very broad rather than narrow, and that can create some problems. You also kind of often want to avoid going past is not a bad problem, but going through areas that have been timbered in the past, and because that hole in the sky, granted, starts allowing all sorts of ground covers and brush and things like that to come up, and if you get stuck coming down a place, you want to get from point A to point B, but in the middle of that is this big area of overgrown stuff. You're going to do a lot of chopping away at things to try and get through there, and it'll be a lot harder to keep that open because it'll want to grow back a lot more vigorously than something that has shade over it. So you often have to back yourself up and angle, you know, start further back, kind of angling around to get around some of these areas. The biggest problem was the unavoidable one of trying to get across the power line cut, because I mean that's just all open, and there's stuff there that's, you know, way over my head in places, and so you're not crossing there, you know. So you really have to find places. In some cases, there were some forest roads that came out that died at the edge of the woods. They actually didn't get out into the cut, but at least you could, you know. It was sort of a starting point to try and push your way out to see if you could find a way out. There is a road that goes, that follows the canal, the power line that the utility people use. And so sometimes you can use a little bit of that to get, there may be a place where their little road gets closer to the south side, say, and so trying to cut your way out to that isn't so far, and you follow their road, and then when it kind of belly, you know, loops over and then gets a little closer to the north side, then you go back in there. So you look for places like that sometimes to try and do it, because again, you know, the maintenance factor would be, make it really difficult if you were not, and also it's not like that's right down by the farmhouse, that's well out there.
It's a hike, yeah, it takes some time.
Yeah, somebody has to schlep out there to do all of this stuff, and particularly if it's something that you're really going to have to do some chopping and stuff on. So you always look for places where that's the case. And then another thing, the sort of lesser thing, it's also when talking about terrain, you're not only trying to not have people going straight up and down hills, but you also don't want them having to be walking along the edge of one, because you're constantly always kind of sliding off here, you know.
Yeah.
So you want to find places where you can either walk along the bottom without being in the water, or walking along the top and without having to, you know, do very awkward things to get up there, but still, once you're up there, that's the better place to be, walking rather than on a hillside, across a hillside. So there's a whole bunch of things. And then, you know, another thing is I've laid out stretches of trail, and then when I went out to blaze it, I realized there are no trees. I mean, that means, I shouldn't say no trees, but, you know, I'm going through an area where most of the trees are like this big, you know, or maybe this big. But
and you're just not going to notice it.
Right. You're not, you can't put a very nice, clear blaze on these things. So you sometimes have to kind of, you know, move around a little bit. You make your trail wiggle around a little bit so that so that at the proper distances, you know, again, it doesn't have to be, you know, cheek to jowl these trees. But, you know, you're going to want to have a blaze every, you know, 20, 30 feet or something like that. And so you have to kind of route it in a way so that there's a tree every 20 or 30 feet. And when you blaze, you don't like to have this, and you can't do it all the time. You can't avoid it all the time. But you don't like to have the blaze for this direction be on the same tree that's for the blaze that's on this direction. Because if you lose that tree, you lose them both. And then when you're walking through the woods, sometimes, you know, depending on how trees or brush or things are like that, sometimes they obscure the next blaze in your direction. But if you just turn around, sometimes you'll find that the tree right next to you has the blaze going in the other direction. So you know you're on the right trail, and you just have to kind of continue down a little further, and then you see the next one. So you always like to have them on different trees as you're moving through the woods. So yeah, just blazing considerations is another element of all of this.
Kind of touched on it before. What does the maintenance of these trails look like?
Well, again, you know, we finished the trail. I got the maps up on these trails 2 years ago, right before COVID hit, or right as COVID was hitting. Literally, the scout whose Eagle Project this was, and I and his dad and a couple people went out on the last day that they would allow anybody to go out in a group. So we really scurried to get out there and do that. That was like in March of 2020. And I say that, but for where, you know, trees have fallen, which, like I say, you can't do anything about that. The fact that these trails have been so well used, there's virtually no serious maintenance that I've seen that we've needed to do. I mean, you know, again, some of the older stretches where they were not built in good places and there's some water issues, that will always be a problem. But the only other thing that you do have to think of sometimes is depending on which tree goes down. If it is a tree that has an important blaze on, so maybe you have to go out and do some blazing. But, you know, you probably won't have to blaze, you know, reblaze, but every, you know, I wouldn't imagine you'd have to do it any more frequently than every 5 years, and maybe longer than that, because, you know, we put, you know, distinct colors up, and we put a lot of blazes up, and again, too, once the trail is so beaten down, you almost don't need blazes anymore, because, I mean,
it's obvious where it goes.
Right. It's not like you're just walking in the woods and going, yeah, now, where am I supposed to go from here? Look, I'm looking for a blaze as being the only indication of whether I go left or right.
Yeah.
And then, too, like I said, we also put the signs up, the plaques up with the laminated maps on them. Now, that is something that may require a little more of a problem, because I've gone up there already and found at least one map that's missing. And I found at least one map and plaque that's missing that is along and, you know, ripped something down. And so, you know, it's like anything else. The more you do, the more you need to do to keep it at that level. So ideally, you know, made a tree identification trail. And, you know, the tree in question, we have a little marker on it that says, you know, names the tree and its Latin name and a couple things. But the tree isn't always like right at your shoulder as you're walking. Sometimes it's set back a little bit. So I walked along the trail and took rocks about this size and had to carry them back there because there was always a rock where I wanted it, and painted them white and set it right down next to the trail so that people could see where, you know, would know, okay, here I need to look to see, because the next tree is here, and people are constantly picking up the damn rocks and you know, chucking them somewhere, and down at the lower end they throw them in the pond, and it's like, what are you doing? What is this?
I mean, that's not what it's for.
It's just I fish them out of the pond all the time, and of the 24 trees that I identified, you know, when to find different species. So 24 different trees. In the time since I finished that, which has now been probably about 5 years, I've lost 5 trees.
Mm.
So I have to go back and find another tree of that species. And it's never, that was the one smart thing I did with that, is that I was going to put the markers up and have them numbered. And then I thought, my gosh, suppose number 4, you know, falls down.
Then and what's the next 4? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then the numbers don't matter
anymore. It may be number 8. So, blessedly, I did not do that. But I've had to do that for at least 3 trees. And now as of this spring, there are 2 more that are down. And one of them, unfortunately, is an ash. I'm never going to find another ash because they're all dead.
Yeah.
Or dying. But anyway, that requires a little more work because, again, you know, you're the more you do, the more you need to do to keep it at that level. And so having a very specific, you know, goal of having a tree identification thing is a bit more work.
What do you think draws people to Brooksvale the most? And then, like, what details, aspects of the park do you think keep people coming back?
I would say the 3 things that are most important are, 1, the farm animals, 2, because that's just for all the little kids, you know, so that's basically brings that whole young family audience in there. And the ponds there too, because they come in the spring and things like that and look for tadpoles and frogs and all sorts of stuff like that and turtles. And so the pond is a big draw, and the farm animals that are there, the rabbits and, you know, all of that stuff. So I'd say the second thing is obviously the sports fields, you know, so you have, and not even just that, even like the cross country team runs the trails, you know, so, we have, you know, that is a major feature. And then the third thing is the hiking. I mean, as I said, especially since we have added all these trails, and there for a while, you know, remember, Sleeping Giant had that catastrophic windstorm come through.
Yes.
And significant areas of the park were closed for a long time, and people were looking for places to hike. And a lot of people found Brooksvale right at the time we had expanded our trails. So
the timing worked out then.
Yes. Yes. We picked up quite a few fans, with that. So I would say those are the 3 biggest things right now. And then some trail related things. I think people come up there and do some of the geocaching and letterboxing and that kind of stuff for those things. The other piece is education, is that we have the maple sugaring program that we have for all the Hamden 4th grade classes. They all come there and do that, and then we'll have days where we just have that, you know, just an open house for anybody to come. There are programs that they run, nature programs that they run in the summer around the gardens. We have the bees there now for as an added thing. So the education portion, I think, is a significant thing, and it also. So is the thing I am really hoping gets leveraged, even as we speak. Well, it was probably this morning, probably isn't now. The superintendent of schools and the head of education, of classroom education, whatever that group, there are about 3 people, I think, from the Board of Ed or from the education department are up there, public schools, as well as the mayor and a couple other people. We're all up there visiting Vinny this morning and talking about, you know, so what can we do with the park in terms of meshing this with the education program. So I really hope that people have, are using their imagination in that way. And also that they are, willing to commit some dollars, because there was a time where there was a sort of assistant ranger, and that person, position wound up being reduced to a half-time person who was just education stuff. And now I don't think they even have anybody. But that person, that's all they did, was to just run educational programs. And I mean, the potential for that is just huge, really, with the school system and then through the summers. So I really hope that they take that seriously. I mean, the biggest chunk of any municipality's budget, town budget, is education, is their schools. And so that's where the money is. So if you want to tap a line item or get a line item in something to pay for something, that's who you want to talk to. That's where you need to go. And this is exactly what, this is right up their alley. I mean, we're talking education here. We're not asking you to buy or do other things. You know, we're saying let's make the most out of the educational opportunities that present themselves here at the park for these kids. And I, you know, really hope that that's where we go with this.
Oh, for sure. And what do you think sets it apart from other parks?
Well, you know, Brooksvale doesn't really have a lot of its geography is not something that really sets it out. You know, I mean, Sleeping Giant is a really neat place to hike. I mean, there's just a lot of great features there that you can go through and really, really, really enjoy what you're going through as a terrain. But what I think Brooksvale, the thing that probably makes it distinctive is its barnyard and the pond next to it, because like I say, it really allows the kids to see animals and things like that and get close to something. They don't have to like get out in the woods and, you know, you may go out for a hike and not see anything. I mean, but you're always going to see something when you go there. And they're also the kinds of things, the pond and the gardens and all that is something that you can very easily build an educational product around, you know. So I think that is a really important feature. It's also one of these things that is really, you know, Vinny is probably going to retire in a year, and he's only the second ranger that they've ever had out there. The guy who preceded him, and I think he's been there now for 23, 24 years. The guy who preceded him had been there for probably similar amount of time, 25 years or more. But there was a year between when the first guy retired and when they hired Vinny, and things just went to pot. I mean, if you don't have somebody there full time, you can't have animals.
Yeah, you need someone to be on top of everything.
Right, right, right. I mean, somebody has to feed them every day. You know, somebody has to make sure there's water every day. Somebody has to check in on them and make sure there's not somebody that's sick or got hurt or something like that every day. You know, I mean, that's somebody has to do that. You cannot leave that position open at all. And so municipalities don't tend to think about things like that very well. You know, so it's a major concern. And then, you know, similar, you know, to that in terms of the animals, a lot of other things, you know, can just deteriorate very quickly. I mean, things overgrow and stuff like that. I mean, those things are not quite as labor intensive to retrieve if it's only a year or so. But if they had to give away all the animals because there was nobody there to tend them, the likelihood of getting a ranger and then getting new animals back in again,
yeah,
zip. And they're just not going to get around to doing that. I mean, they don't have the commitment to that kind of a thing. That's the kind of thing, hopefully, though, that the Friends of Brooksvale is there to kind of lobby for that and to make sure that people are thinking, you know, about what they're doing and not leaving things, you know, just kind of to chance. With this stuff. I mean, for example, the animal barn was something that the Friends of Brooksvale raised the money for. Those animals all used to live in these little sheds all through the winter. It was horrible.
Yeah, that's not good.
It was ridiculous to think that they had to sit there with the minimal shelter that they had through a winter. I mean, it's just terrible. So, and that had been that way for decades. You know, I mean, they weren't in the big barn.
Yeah, and that's just not, that's something that's just not sustainable.
Right, right, right. And quite honestly, I'm surprised that the animal people who inspect these kinds of things even allowed that to happen. I think ultimately there was finally some pressure that they needed to do something, and so the Friends went ahead with that. But you know, so that's going to be a very key role for the Friends of Brooksvale is to really be there and saying, look, this position, the ranger position, is absolutely essential, and it has to be seamless from when one end, you know, when one stops and the other starts. In fact, they should overlap so that one person really understands all of the nitty gritty of how to do all of this
and can learn from Vinny while he's still there.
Right, 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 right. Exactly. I mean, just how you order things, and I don't mean order like on your computer. I mean the order of things and all the routines that you have to do, and what are the needs of the animals, and even a particular animal that may have a particular problem. You're not going to divine that just by walking up to it. I mean, you need to have somebody explain that to you. You know, somebody has to go through all of that with you. And then I think too, they really do need a second person in there who's going to be a full-time education person. I think that would be absolutely fantastic for the town. I mean, when they had it, I think there was so much more that was offered, you know, for people to come and see and do. But you know, without that, it's you know, you just lose a lot. And you know, the more that there is there, the more that's going on, the more people come up, the more people then are wanting more and are advocating for the park, and it builds its own enthusiasm, you know. I think the other thing I forgot to mention is that there also are events up there. There is a pavilion up there and things like that. So people hold different events up there from time to time. When you were talking about one of the main uses of the park, there used to be some other things. I mean, there used to be an orienteering group that would, I mean, they do things all over Southern Connecticut, but occasionally they would come up, have an orienteering day up there where they'd set up a whole course and have people going through the whole thing. I remember doing that one time. There used to be an archery course up there.
I saw that when I went on my little tour. Peter took me on a little tour, and I remember seeing that it's a clearing now.
It's a series of lines of sight because, I mean, you know what disc golf is?
Yes.
Yeah, well, imagine a disc golf course, but you're shooting arrows instead of throwing discs.
Yeah.
You need to have some path through the woods. You can't just throw a disc just randomly through the woods. I mean, there usually has to be some sort of, you know, basic line of sight where you're going.
Yeah, I remember.
It's just like a golf course, you know, how it goes in a dog legs or does whatever it's going to do. So they had set these things up just like that. So you go from A and you shoot your arrows, you go up, and then you start from there and you shoot to the next place and you work your way all the way through. It was just, like I said, just like a golf course in a way.
Yeah, I remember Peter showing me, or at least showing me the area where that was when we went on our tour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, those guys sort of aged out, and there was a very dwindling number of people who were involved in that. So that finally kind of just extinguished itself. But the other thing too, like I was saying, there was that, I mentioned the one trail that's sort of a birder's trail. There are people who come up there specifically for birding. People used to come up there and do more some mountain biking and things, but that was, one, it was very damaging to the trails, and two, it was very disruptive to people who hiked and to the wildlife. And so it would be nice at some point to have a trail that was specifically designated for them, but we really haven't worked out how to do that, where to go. I mean, not that it would be exclusively for them, but it would be there, you know, rather than having them going all over the place, say, okay, if you want to come up and do it,
it's like their designated area.
Right, this is your trail, you can go ahead and do this loop or whatever. So we may work out something with that ultimately. We'll have to kind of see.
Sure.
But that's been on the drawing board for quite a while.
What would make the experience of going to Brooksvale more convenient and enjoyable for you?
Well, I'm not there anymore. I live in Guilford, so they want to move the park over here. That'd be great. When I lived there, Well, one of the things, and this is a relatively minor thing, when we expanded the trails, we created new points of entry, which was a really good thing, because one, everybody didn't have to crowd into the parking lot if you wanted to go hiking there or doing whatever you wanted to do. They do have a parking issue when there are bigger events. Like, for example, I guess the other thing, when I said about events, the big event actually is the Fall Festival, because then, you know, several thousand people come to that, and parking is a real issue at that point. There are also smaller programs during the year, like I said, like the Maple Sugaring Day. There's usually a wreath making day. Vinny at one point had a snowshoe making class. That was only not very many people, but I mean, but there would be a few things like that that we would try and do through the year. We would really like if we could get the barn up and running again. I mean, get it fixed, because the foundation is literally shifting. They're going to have to do some major work to shore up the foundation and fix the roof and do all sorts of stuff. But if that barn could be fixed up, there's a lot of stuff you could do up there. We had some barn dances up there at one point. We, you know, it'd be nice to have, you know, sort of an art installation, or have a day where there's sort of art in the park, and it could, you know, you could have people setting up things around where the barn is, where people would be maybe just playing some music, or they'd be doing some, you know, bringing their craft up there, or they'd be, you know, an artist would be doing some plein air painting or something, and, you know, having that kind of a thing. It would be nice if the barn, really the big barn, really got fixed up so that it could be turned into a venue for activities. That, I would say, would be one of the really big things. Going back, though, to what I said about the points of entry, we put up an Eagle Scout put up a nice big board right at the trailhead at the center of the park, and another Eagle Scout put one up at the end of Julian Drive for that entrance. But we really could use a couple more of those, one at the head of Tom Swamp Road and the other up at the corner of Brooksvale and I don't know what that road is, where Brooksvale Park basically ends almost at the Cheshire border. There's a road that goes left there. So at that corner is another entry point. So again, these would be places where if we could make better parking there, that's one thing. And two, have these boards where we could put the big trail maps up and that kind of stuff. I think that would be very helpful. So that and the barn, I think, are probably the two really big things. Another thing, and I don't know whether this, there's kind of two minds of this, but the pond, when you create a pond, it's not like you're building a swimming pool. I mean, you know, it's not like it's a cement bottom or a whatever. Usually what they do is they sort of put down sort of a layer of sort of clay that is semi-impermeable.
Yeah.
So the water will not just, you know, soak in. Whatever was done to create the pond, that no longer really functions.
Mm.
And so the pond goes from a pond to a field often by the end of summer. And it would be nice if that situation could be fixed, because, I mean, one, you could have year-round fish in there. I mean, which it would change things, because right now it's effectively a big vernal pool, which is wonderful for salamanders and frogs and toads and things like that, because there's no fish in there to eat them. You know, because they can't stay. There's not water, you know, 365 days, so there's no fish. So it would be nice if there was a way to, I mean, you're going to have to balance those things. But there, for example, there used to be lighting and people used to go out there and ice skate every winter. And to some extent, they still do, depending on whether this water. And the basement of the Veterans Building, there's a nice fireplace in there, and it's been outfitted in a way that, you know, people could come in there, they could have a fire and do that kind of a thing. So that would be a nice function to kind of see in the park again, you know, at least the ice skating part. I don't think the fishing is probably a viable thing, or maybe even a desirable thing. But being able to have it such that at least you could have water there in the winter so that you could do the ice skating again. They actually used to have even a little ski slope up there.
Yes, I remember, was it? It might have been Peter again who on our tour was showing me where that was.
Yeah, you know the bridge at the end of the pond? There's that big...
Yep. Sort
of, well, if you cross that bridge, go just a little bit. If you look up to your left, you're crossing a field, but the field runs up the hill. That was the ski slope.
Okay.
And you look on, there's still on one of the trees, you'll see this. It looks like the rim of a wheel, you know, like where the tire would fit in the,
yep,
in the little depression. That actually was where the rope tow rope went over that. And because they had a little rope tow there to
get people up. Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. So we're not going to do a ski slope, but I think the skating might be something that's not a bridge too far in terms of
seeing
that. I think the other thing that they need to do need to look into is there is a sort of a dilapidated structure just up the Red Trail. It's sort of a cabin, but the walls keep getting broken, getting smashed up, because every time they lock it up, somebody wants to break into it. So, I mean, it's not something, it's probably not something that you either are going to do it but leave it unlocked, or you're just going to make it a pavilion. But it would be nice, actually, to have at least a second pavilion for people to have events, because right now you have the one, and then that's it. You know, if somebody else wants to have something at the same time, you could have it indoors at the Veterans Building, but you don't have an alternative. So the new Beers property that the 42 acres, there was a house and a swimming pool and a tennis court up there. They had to rip all that out because it's open space. I don't know whether they'd be allowed to put a pavilion up there, but I mean, that might be another alternative place to have another pavilion. What was I just thinking there though? The pavilions, there are some, they need to I'm getting ahead of myself here. There are some lean-tos up there. They definitely need to, the scouts definitely need to engage in the park more than they do. They've developed a lot. I think what happened is the park used to be a go-to place. And when it was allowed to kind of, you know, fall apart, they found other places to go to. And now that the park is in better shape, they're not coming back.
Yeah.
Because they've developed their alternatives. So we have three big Adirondacks up there that essentially never get used. We now have this whole new open space where the house and the pool and the swimming and the tennis court were, that could be a big camping area. But again, you have to lure people to come back and use those places. So they really need to do some outreach to groups like that, to scouts and stuff like that, and try and get them back up there and doing things, and utilizing those areas. Cause I think there's good utility to be derived from the park if they did that. They also need to get another, bathroom built up there. Because the one they have has never really been in great shape. It always seems to be kind of on the fritz. And they really should create something better, more updated and reliable for that.
Do you have ideas for how to get people interested in nature, hiking, and parks in general, specifically with the fusion of handheld apps and those kind of things?
One thing is not to underestimate the intelligence and the interest of your audience. I think, especially when you have, when things can be done electronically, you can layer the information in there so that, you know, if I want to go ahead and read something in a pamphlet or a book or something like that, the only choice there is to start at the beginning and read through. And I can skip to chapters and things like that, but and you can organize chapters around sort of an introduction and leave it at that, or then you can skip the introduction and move on to another chapter if you want. But, you know, with a lot of the with the digitalizing things, I mean, you can give sort of an overview, and then you can go ahead and talk a little bit more about some major things, and then you can go ahead and you can just go deeper and deeper and follow different threads, but just allow the person to click and go where they want to. And it's not, you won't overwhelm somebody because they just stop clicking in that particular direction or in that particular line of information and they move on to something else. But the person who really wants to learn more, you know, can now learn more. So you can have a good thing on the history of the area. You can have a good thing about the geology, about the, you know, the flora, the fauna and things like that, what's changed over times. You know, there's a lot of things you can put some, one of the things that would be really nice would be to have some, to start having some talks up there, or to start linking, for example, perhaps some of the talks that are given elsewhere, like at the Hamden Lamb Trust or things like that, and link those things to there. So if you want to learn something about the geology of the area, there might have been a talk that was done at the Hamden Lamb Trust about the geology of that area. So you don't have to like redo it, or you don't have to bring your own speaker in or do all the research yourself and put it in there. You just link to that particular talk that's already archived somewhere. So I think looking around and having better linkages with other entities out there would be really helpful, because you can bring, they have information and they develop information. That it would be nice to sort of cross-pollinate with this.
Sure. So
like the Hampton Historical Society would be another one, you know, because they know a lot about the, you know, the history of the place and that kind of thing.
And that actually segues perfectly into the next question, which are there any aspects of the history of Brooksvale not found on the Hamden website that you'd like to see added to the app?
I can't say that I know chapter and verse about what's on the website, so I maybe I needed to have had that as a homework assignment before.
That's okay. I'll relay the information back.
But I think there are things though that go hand in hand with that. I mean, what is the geology of the area? You know, I mean that's deep history, but that's history too. And how did that geology affect the history, the human history, you know, so the Native American history, the farming history and that kind of stuff, you know, what was, you know, how, you know, it's not the greatest farming land. So, you know, what was the impact of that? Also, and this is sort of a relation to that is how did the land change over time? You know, I mean, it was a big forest for the longest time. And whatever incursions that the Native Americans made were relatively small compared to the kind of things that we do. But I mean, things get farmed and then the farms go away and they get they may go from crops to livestock. I mean, that was a big thing here in Connecticut where a lot of farms moved to sheep raising. Somebody was telling me that a lot of the walls that are there weren't created because people took the stones out of the field so they could grow the crops. They took the stones and built the walls to keep the sheep in. Mm. So there's a couple, like for example, there's a really good book called Something the Forest Landscape. Not Observing the Forest Landscape. I'll have to find that. Anyway, but it's a book that basically tells you as you're walking through the woods what is it you're seeing. You know,
that'd be important,
right? So for example, I mean, if you see a bunch of trees down, when did they fall? Well, okay, you would need to know if you knew the direction that they fell. That would tell you what season of the year that happened, because the storms come from different directions at different times.
In different seasons, yeah.
So if there's a big windfall here at such a time, that was a winter storm, or that was a hurricane in the fall, or whatever. And so, and then how long ago did it happen? Well, how big of trees are they? You know, how have they rotted? Certain trees rot from the inside out, other ones rot from the outside in. So one, you can tell what kind of trees they were. Two, you can tell to some degree how long ago it was by how much deterioration they had. And you can go back further than that. You see these hummocks and you wonder what the heck they were. Well, that was often where a tree had fallen a long time ago and pulled up a whole bunch of dirt. The tree is entirely gone now, but the hummock is still there.
Yeah.
You go through an area, sometimes you see all these hummocks and you can see that, at some point there must have been a major storm to have taken down, so many trees in a particular area. So he goes through all sorts of things like that in terms of, being able to divine how the land was used. Was it used for grazing? Was it used for farming? Was it, what is the verb or the participle? Reading the forest landscape.
Mm.
Reading the forest landscape. Those kinds of things are really terrific because they really allow you to learn an awful lot as you're walking through. And then just learning what the different flora and fauna are and learning. I mean, there's a guy named, Jim Zip. No, not Jim Zip. Jim Search, who works down at the Peabody Museum. And he often leads hikes up through here in Hamden. And, it's amazing. I mean, he'll sit there and he'll point out all these different plants and why this particular thing is such an important plant, because it's really good winter feed for particular animals or particular birds or things like that. And then why is this thing not good? Because that's an invasive that maybe it has nice berries, but nobody will eat those things. They're toxic, or they're just not the kind of food that sustains, or they don't have the rich caloric content of the plants that they're displacing. So there's all sorts of information like that. It's really, really cool that you can find stuff. And they say you could just layer this on down let people go as far. Like if you go up to the Mashantucket Pequot Museum, they'll give you these little speaker things and you walk around there and you push a button and it'll tell you what it is you're looking at, what that exhibit is. And it says, if you'd like to learn more, press 2. So you press 2 and it'll go on for another several minutes. It says, if you'd like to learn still more, press 3 and off you go. And so you can go as far as you want or not, or you can move on to the next thing. That kind of a quality, that kind of a functionality within the electronic system, I think is fabulous. And I think you want to try and provide as much information and as much diverse information about all different kinds of things and the way, and also how things interact. Why is this the way it is, or why is this important, or what is the disruptive effect that we're having, or that invasives are having, or whatever, things like that. It's the old, I think it's John Muir who said, or maybe it's Thoreau. I always forget the two. Who says, if you find a thread in nature and pull on it, you find that it's attached to everything else. It's everything is interconnected, and appreciating that rich interconnectedness is what is so important, and it's probably one of the most important lessons that we could possibly convey from an experience at Brooks Vale is that just how valuable all of this diversity is there, and why maintaining the integrity of ecosystems and valuing that is just so important.
Talk about some of the landmarks on the trails and kind of where they're found, and are they documented? Is there a way for people to find these landmarks?
Well, again, that's a little bit of a problem with Brooksville. Like I said, the geology there, the geography there, is just not that unusual. I can't really think of there being that many points. Once you get back in the woods, you're basically really just kind of back in the woods. I mean, there's a few glacial erratics, but I don't know that. And Vinny could probably help them point out where some of those are. Beyond that, you don't get a lot of elevation, so there's not like you get to some vista somewhere. There are some little streams that you cross, but not much that has much water other than Hemlock Brook, which comes down to the pond. That probably has the most water in it. But you're probably not going to see an awful lot in that. Again, it's not a place that's noteworthy for its geography, really, for its features. I mean, you know, there's a lot of rock walls and things like that, but nothing that really. There's one that's sort of a place with it that looks like no one really knows what the hell it is, where it looks like it's almost like the foundation of something, but it's not really clear what that was. Or why it was there. The foundation of the old house is still so overgrown, you really wouldn't even know it was there. I stumbled on it just purely by accident.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. I mean, even if they just do like the stuff that is there right now, like where. In the general scheme of things, where like the barn is, where the veterans building is, where and then just the trails themselves, I think that's something. So,
and like I said, we did put trail. I mean, if they haven't gotten knocked down, but at all of the major intersections of the trails, we have a plaque with a map, so that you always know where you are.
Yeah,
you know, whenever you get to a place where you have to like, you know, should I be going left? Should I be going right? Where is that going to take me? There's the map. You know where it's going.
Which is definitely handy.